Erotic wisdom is when you finally are content with your own being and you self-validate and you start to self-generate. And that's when erotic innocence comes back, because now you let go of all these judgments and good, bad, right, wrong. And you sit with, well, this is very pleasurable for me. And I don't have to act on it because it's not appropriate in this instance, but over here it is. And so you have better choice-making abilities. So that reclamation of innocence is part of the evolutionary process. It could happen before stage five, but in general, it seems to be one where a person allows themselves to be more oriented inwardly and less externally oriented, more aware of and being okay with their own unique set of erotic fingerprinting, let's say, like their way of being in the world that. And it seems to be also a natural progression, because when you get to this place of relaxing about your sexual nature, suddenly you experience eroticism everywhere with all things.
Hello and welcome to Talking Flow with Rafan Kebe, a podcast dedicated to creativity, sensuality, and resilience, and how those three qualities can help us be in flow with who we are and what we can become. You're about to listen to a conversation that was first published on a podcast called Sweet Blasphemy, Sensual, Sexual, and the Sacred. Hence, you will hear this name being mentioned. To make a long story short, I have decided to combine and upgrade two podcasts into one. The first one, Talking, Teaching, and Flow, was mainly about the art of teaching and coaching, and the other being Sweet Blasphemy. This is now the Talking Flow with Rafan Kebe, a podcast dedicated to, again, creativity, sensuality, and resilience. Thank you for your understanding and patience. Please stay in touch and go to rafan.co.uk for all the updated links and biographies. Enjoy this conversation. So the plan for today is for us to talk about Eros, because I know that you are very, very interested in him. You're going to have to tell me. I know it's a god. But we'll speak some more about that. And we'll possibly speak also about attraction and desires.
Yeah, I would love to do that. Yeah, sounds delicious. Let's do it.
Beautiful. I am listening to a book right now where desire has been defined as the knowledge of what one wants. I quite like that. So perhaps we can stay and we can start with that. Desire. How do you define desire?
Yeah, I think for me, desire, at some point I was trying to sort it out, you know, because if you've been ever on a spiritual path, and you are a little bit because you're in the yoga world, anytime you dip into meditation, yoga, any of these kinds of things, there's going to be a hint of this, where desire is the cause of all suffering. And we need to somehow control this crazy energy and get over it and blah, blah. So for a long time, this didn't make sense to me, because I've always had a very, very healthy relationship with desire. And when I started to think about it and also discuss it, it became clear that if we got rid of all desire, we would absolutely do nothing. We wouldn't even go for a glass of water. We wouldn't eat. We would do literally nothing. So desire is a motivational force. I think that's the description in psychology. It's this thing that motivates us to do something. So that's a very important force. But that didn't satisfy me. It did not satisfy me. That sounds like work ethic crap, you know? So when I examined my own relationship, which is a philosophical approach, you know, to a topic where you examine your direct experience, let's say, I started to feel like desire was a very intimate voice. Call it like a visceral voice. It's when there's an ache in your heart, or an ache in your loins, or an ache in your being for something. But I felt like that ache was coming from a very deep place. So the way I define it now is that desire is the visceral voice of our own essence. And it's like a little clue as to what we're here to actually do and experience in our life. And if we can release the words of sin and karma and all these things we actually don't understand very well, mm-hmm. and really listen and then acknowledge, and even if we don't choose to act, we can still be inflamed with energy from the thing that is calling us. Mm-hmm. But eventually, if it is a true desire, we'll have to surrender to it, and it will require sacrifice. It will require that things die away, that they have some difficult conversations, for example, or you know, let go of the job that's been killing you for 10 years and finally go out into the unknown. So it is a disturbing call for a lot of people. And I think that's another reason why we avoid it or try and control it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So
that's my definition.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot more I can say, but I think I'll pause there because I think it's a good place to let you speak to anything that, you know, arises around that definition.
Yeah. Well, the simple fact that you've defined desire as a force, energy, that at some point is going to have to be responded to. And I'm sure we're going to be talking about transcendence, where mm-hmm. we are now trying to somehow convey this energy into something ideally positive. Mm-hmm. At some point, you mentioned the word sacrifice. There's going to be a need for a sacrifice of sorts. So let me press you on that. Can you tell us some more as to what desire can force us to somehow sacrifice?
Yes. Well, I mean, it could be your entire life. Mm-hmm. I've had moments where desire, say, your desire comes not only around Eros. There is other forms of desire. You might want to create a family. Or maybe you don't. So for me, I don't have that desire to make babies, but mm-hmm. my partners had such a strong desire. What do you think was the sacrifice? I had to let go of, at that time, the love of my life so that he could fulfill that desire. And I don't just go along with it because it's his mm-hmm. desire. It's a big sacrifice, because to find someone you're compatible with and deeply in love with, and then you're confronted by a big desire like this.
Yeah.
It's heartbreaking sometimes, but he now has a family, we're friends, and life is good. So the sacrifice doesn't have to remain painful. It's an offering, let's say, to the mm-hmm. old gods. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, okay, I give you this thing, but for the greater cause. That's been true also, like say when I did my PhD, I had to sacrifice a lot of time, I had to change a lot of things about my world in order to study deeply. Mm-hmm. And it was 12-hour days on the computer and, you know, all of this stuff. So it affected my relationships and my life pretty drastically for a while.
I can imagine.
But the end result is that it's facilitated, training my mind to think more. And it's also given me, let's say, credentials that allow people to listen to me a little bit more, which is absolutely ridiculous because I'm not really saying anything different than before the PhD. Mm-hmm. But now people are like, oh, okay, we need to listen to this. But that was a sacrifice as well. But there was a strong call, because the contribution, which is the bigger call, the bigger desire, that was a step in that step toward what I'm here to do.
Yeah.
There was no way for me to do what I'm doing now without some kind of solid credentials. It's too shaky, the ground. Mm-hmm. So that's what I mean by sacrifice. A lot will be asked of you when it's a true desire. Maybe it is about sexuality. I meet plenty of people who desire, say, someone of the same sex, and it's not allowed, but they ache for it. They dream about it. They fantasize about it. And if they were to experiment with it, the sacrifice would be enormous, because they would be confronted by social constructs. Maybe their relationship couldn't sustain it. Maybe their kind of status in the world of how they define themselves would have to change if they came forward with that as a choice. These are not little decisions, but the desire remains so strong. It's such a strong call that I find these sacrifices, they're like initiations. They bring more of us out. And that, I think, is what the purpose of our essence, la raison d'être, mm-hmm. is for that. It's not for us to become the thing everyone else wants us to be. It's to become the thing we already are, deeply in our essence.
Deeply, yeah. Thank you for that. As you mentioned sexuality, I'm also thinking about identity. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking back to, I've heard Elizabeth Gilbert, the author of The Big Magic and Eat, Pray, Love, being asked, what was the best advice she was ever given? And she responded, it came in the form of a question by a mentor of sorts that said, what are you willing to sacrifice to become the person that you pretend to want to be?
Wow, that is very good.
Yeah, yeah, it puts you right there.
Yeah.
Because sacrifices are very much part of the deal.
Yeah.
And if you have any strong desire or desire that you now have to respond to, have to make, you know, amends for, sacrifice is just going to be part of the game, isn't it? Whether they're sexual,
yes,
or not.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's why, if you look historically, almost every tradition would make an offering of some kind. Not always a human sacrifice or an animal sacrifice, although those did happen historically. But there was a sacrifice of something, an offering. I'm imagining, I don't know the etymology of sacrifice, but it must have like sacred something, you know, it must have that kind of connotation.
I can imagine. Mm-hmm.
But the willingness to give away something that's precious to you in order to facilitate transformation has always been part of the human initiatory path. And it's no different with sexuality and eros if we really do want to fully express the sexual being that we are. Mm-hmm. It's going to ask that we let go of all kinds of things, including, for many, letting go of being a victim to their past.
I see. Letting go of being a victim of their past.
Yeah.
Cool. I am making a note of this. I definitely want us to come back to it.
Okay.
Eros and sacredness, and the sacredness of Eros. Can we delve into this? And I promise we are going to come back to the point you just made.
Yes. Well, let's be personal for a moment with myself. Mm-hmm. Eros has always been part of my life, but I didn't fully understand the significance of it until actually, I would say, a year ago when things were really, you know, we went into the first lockdown, there was all kinds of stuff going on. And there was this confrontation of the entire world between life and death, aliveness and, you know, just giving up and becoming a nothing. And so I realized there's no way in this planet I'm going to give up Eros, no matter what is going on. And so I went on an inquiry, and this doesn't mean I went out and had sex with tons of people. I actually was a nun.
We'll see.
I was examining Eros in Greece, because I thought, let's go to the birthplace of this being, and examining as well as a force of nature, what is Eros? And so the idea is that Eros is that which animates all of life. It's been hijacked to mean sex. But a Greek person properly using the word Eros, which is a type of love energy.
We'll see.
When they go to a rock concert and it really turns them on and they're like, rah, they're like, oh, I'm so full of Eros. They have a different, a wider spectrum of how they use the word.
I see.
And I like this. So imagine that Eros also could mean that which lights us up, that which turns us on. And there's only an on-off switch. So we want to be turned on the majority of the time. Because then we're engaging in life very consciously, right? Instead of being kind of numb and shut down and going through the motions and being a living zombie at that point.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow, amazing. How much time did you spend in Greece delving into this?
Well, over the years meant a lot of time, but last year was specifically 3 months. As a Canadian, you're allowed 90 days. So I literally on day 90, like had to depart. But yes, and for the most part alone, and for the most part in nature. And wow, the download of just being with that raw primal earth, and then in my own psyche, what was happening is I was coming apart, all the parts of me that had negotiated these covert contracts, let's say, in my relationship with friends, with life, where I willingly turn my eros down or even off to make other people comfortable, for example. Mm-hmm. And there was an absolute like fire that emerged in my being saying, no more. Mm-hmm. This is going to fully occupy my being at all times. And if you're uncomfortable with it, that's your problem, not mine. And I'm not doing anything that's going to offend you. I'm very intuitive in my social settings. Mm-hmm. But even if you're careful, some people are just offended because you're feeling alive.
And that's something. Yes, mm-hmm. It's true.
So we should be living first and primarily for that own, our own essence, and marinating in that essence and discovering and being, having reverence for this aspect of who we are. So that we actually succeed in the individuation process. It's very important for all psyches, all people, no matter where you come from. And for some, maybe Eros will be a little less important, but I can tell you, even when I've done like corporate talks, don't even mention sex at all. Mm-hmm. There's a lineup of people who want to talk to me and they all ask me about sex. And there's nothing in my bio. There's nothing that I say. Mm-hmm. The thing that is killing them, the thing that is at the source of their unhappiness is this area. And like you said at the start of the podcast, we are not willing to comfortably, openly, or even uncomfortably talking about something that's extremely natural and very human.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have a very similar experience. Doing podcast, doing IGTV lives on Instagram, having conversations, fairly serious conversation about work when I end up, you know, working as a consultant or as a teacher somewhere where we do what needs to be done and talked about what needs to be talked about. And then the lights go off, so to speak, and you know, you stop recording. And I ended up quite a few times having an hour long podcast about something and then an hour and a half conversation afterwards, and it always comes back down to the same thing. Conversation mm-hmm. about relationships, how to relate to another, sex to an extent, and how to be more oneself in its entirety. And that seems to be something that is obviously not necessarily an issue, but something of importance to all of us, to absolutely all of us. So that's I'm so very grateful you brought that up, because the Sweet Blasphemy podcast is exactly for that. Is an extension of those conversations that you want to have in private, which I'm hoping people will be having with me publicly, basically, about Eros and the other guiding forces. Now, are there any other gods and guiding forces such as Eros that you've delved into?
Yeah, well, I like the Grecian ones because Western minds are the fabric of how we have created the Western thought. It does emanate from Greece. So we have, even on a subconscious or unconscious level, adopted a lot of these concepts. I think there's over 3,000 Greek words in the English language alone. I mean, we're infused with this culture without understanding it. Yep. So I really like... obviously, Dionysus, he's a very misunderstood male archetype. Mm-hmm. And I think he's very important right now because he's the male archetype that is all about beauty and love and pleasure. And we associate male archetypes with violence and destruction. And we say, you know, patriarchy and all the destructiveness of that, but we don't really hold the full spectrum of what the male archetype holds. And Dionysus was basically, you know, killed in the psyche at some point. It's not allowed to exist. There cannot be a masculine energy that that is adoring of beauty and is delighting in the frivolous realms of pleasure. I mean, come on. Mm-hmm. There was a much deeper part. He also, you know, was a translator between the underworld and our world. And he was an initiating force. So this is an important part of our psyche to bring back. Especially, I think, because it is the masculine, we often attribute these things to the feminine.
Interesting point. Mm. Oh, thank you for that.
Yeah. And then the other would be, obviously, I'm intrigued by Aphrodite because she is the goddess of love and beauty. And not so much about her specifically, but I like the rituals that were created to honor her. So actually the first concept of marriage, Aphrodite, her name is Mare, and like meaning she came from the foam of the sea, la mer, right? And so if lovers in the ancient times wanted to make offering of their love to Aphrodite, they had to get quote unquote married, which meant to be blessed by a priestess of an Aphrodite temple so that their love was consecrated. And then every act of loving was therefore an immediate offering to Aphrodite.
I see.
Yes. And so actually when I was married with my partner, that was the version of marriage we chose, not the contractual version. So I think that that's very interesting. And then the other is in her, the old temples. I mean, when men would return from a battle or war, these kinds of things, they would first go to those temples and have the atrocity and the pain and the PTSD and all of that loved out of them by being submerged and emerged and infused by beauty. And I'm not just talking sex, we're talking poetry, dance, art, music, beautiful beings that were just putting love back into your being so that when you went back to your village, you were a safe man. You weren't going to take out your rage and your pain on children and the women.
Deep. Mm-hmm.
Wow. So those rituals are gone. They're long gone, but I'm fascinated by them.
Mm-hmm. It does sound fascinating. Mm. And to understand and to realize that this wisdom has been there for such a long time already, that we simply need to walk ourselves back to it. You know, not pretending that we are reinventing the wheel.
Yes.
I love that. There's such a humility to be found in there.
So I want to bridge the gap a little bit because I think it's important. Mm-hmm. So the reason I'm obsessed with these characters, one, is that beauty is, for me, the food of our soul. And we're not feeding the soul enough beauty. We have so much pain and destruction. Most of the news, the focus is on those things. So there's a beauty anorexia, let's say. And when we allow just a little bit of beauty, like sunlight on the skin, the smell of a flower, and the smile on a stranger's face that just lights up your day, whatever it might be. Although now we have masks, so we can't see smiles. But in general, if we could see the smile. And then bridging it a little further into how modern humans have now made pleasure frivolous when it's actually exceptionally necessary for optimal functioning of all systems in the human body, including mental health and being able to think in a creative way. So it's an atrocity that we are so against pleasure that we can't even handle those sounds, but we can handle scenes of people being killed and blown up and hurt and bleeding and abused every single day, the amount of violence that we take in. And we're offended by a slight sound of pleasure. This needs to indicate something to us.
Do you have any explanation as to any ideas to how to explain that?
Well, I think obviously, you know, the way that the system works is fear. When you use fear, say in media, it's a great way to capture people's attention because the human mind is designed to, it will relax, but it's going to spend a lot of energy on things that might be alarming because it used to be a saber-toothed tiger, but there wasn't one every 3 minutes or every 5 seconds. Or, you know, we had repose, we had moments of, so I sense that the use of fear and the use of violence keeps us in that amygdala, that very emotional, irrational place, and it's a perfect place to hold a consumer because you can kind of sell them anything at that point. To think rationally, to use your front brain, the prefrontal cortex, you have to have a parasympathetic state. Mm-hmm. It won't come online otherwise. So I'm thinking these days, well, we need that more than ever if we're going to face the bigger problems in a really creative way that's actually for the greater good of everyone.
Yeah. Thank you for that. That's great. Now, to talk about sex and perhaps more precisely eroticism, it seems like everyone feels entitled to it, good sex, good life of some sort in relation to when it comes to erotic way of living. But virtually no one feels very fulfilled. And if we can tap into that dissonance between all of us wanting something and yet at the same time most of us being unhappy with what we already have. Now, I'm obviously talking about and hinting at the various stages of erotic evolution that I want us to delve into. But what are your thoughts on the fact that many of us, is it just a case of the grass is greener on the other side, are so unhappy with what we've got and what we have, and yet we feel entitled to many, many, many other things that we are not necessarily willing to work for, sacrifice for, or give to others?
Right. This is a rich question. There's a lot of things to answer to this question. Mm-hmm. Definitely, there's an entitlement culture now more than ever. And I'm not quite sure why that's existing other than maybe consumerism at its best. We've been taught to desire, want. If you have this, you'll be happy. Until you have this, you'll be even happier. And when you have this and this and this and this, you'll be happier and happier. So there's this lack of, if we really had true pleasure, if we focused on that and the experience, a direct experience of pleasure, you couldn't sell us much because the human body is capable of entering states of bliss and ecstasy like that and sustaining them. That's what these ancient paths of Tantra and Taoism and these other conscious lineages harnessed thousands and thousands of years ago. They understood that. The modern person, we've made a commodity of sex. It's just a thing that you swipe and you check off and you get. And so we're like beggars. And then when we take something, it's almost like being a thief. When you take something, you don't really enjoy it because you've taken it and you have to hurry through the experience. But when you actually self-generate it or consciously co-create an experience, you pay attention, you drop into it, you experience, truly experience pleasure, which is a very vulnerable act for everybody.
Yeah, I hear you. I understand what you mean. Totally. Going
then,
from... I'm so sorry. Go for it.
No, please go.
No, I was just going to comment on what you said in terms of developing this sense and this feeling of scarcity, where just by the way we behave towards our erotic needs and the way we go about getting our sex on creates this scarcity mindset where you feel like you have to rob it. You have to be a thief of some sort. Yes. There's a certain amount of guilt attached to it. Hence the rise of Puritanism, although promiscuity is also right there, right next to it. And as you're mentioning, when we allow, or when we find ourselves in a place of power, where we delve into our inner resources, there is now this state of abundance that so goes against scarcity. And one can understand, or one can fathom an idea as to why, you know, the forces that be, so to speak, would want to keep you in a space of scarcity where you can be controlled and manipulated that much better, that much more. And I'm not much of a theorist when it comes to, you know, society is there and it's evil and all those things, but we've got to appreciate that at times we are being played against each other and against ourselves. So, yeah. Those were my thoughts as you were saying those beautiful words. Thank you for the explanation.
Yeah, so I think that We've done massive disservice. In fact, I've had some very interesting conversations with like Christian priests, for example, who have come to the conclusion that in some ways, Christianity, these are not my words, these come from the priest, saying, mm-hmm. you know, we've really made a mistake when we made the act of sex and pleasure a sin. Mm-hmm. So what I want to talk about here is the it's not evil, but we'll use that word, presence of what's called a hijacked desire. And then we can come back to the evolutionary stages.
Please do.
It's very mm-hmm. important mm-hmm. to understand how this primal force, this force of nature that has always been part of life and it's emergent, it evolves, it's leading us, it's guiding us. We can actually trust it. That very natural, pure calling, let's say, because desire is a calling. Mm-hmm. Calling us to contribute. It's calling us to be in a situation where we could be in love or create a child or make love or, you know, whatever the things that it's calling us towards. Maybe it's even just towards the divine. I mean, there's Saint Teresa de Avila was in the state of rapture around God all the time. Mm-hmm. She was in an ecstatic state and it was just her and God. So it's not always intercourse, these things. So, you know, this spectrum of, this calling and then the disservice to, I think what has happened is the hijacking of that. And what I mean by that is imagine social constructs or mandates or familial ideals. For example, only have sex when you're married is such a construct. Yeah. It's a little bit of a ridiculous thing because I really believe you need to test drive before you get the thing.
Yeah, before you buy. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, in the old days, there's a really wonderful story of oolongs, and this is blasphemous to speak about, but I'm going to speak about it.
Please do.
In the tribal Philippines, and I heard this from an elder, but you will not find information on this. You know, this was an orally transmitted piece of information that touched my heart very deeply. And he shared that in the old days, there were these things called the oolongs. I think that's how you pronounce it. Basically, where when you started to menstruate as a young girl or you came to a certain age as a boy, you would cohabitate with people of your own age group. And a few elder women would be watching over and guiding. And pleasure was encouraged. The children could explore, which they do. Children explore. They want to discover things. Mm-hmm. What was absolutely not allowed was intercourse. Everything else was. And what ended up happening, and they would be in that place till they were, you know, of age to marry, 17, 18 years old around then. By that time, they actually had found their life partner. Mm-hmm. And the divorce rates were exceptionally low. Because they were allowed to play and discover pleasure and then compatibility in an organic fashion. Mm. And it was understood that why not allow for this very natural behavior, but guide it. Don't let it go unguided.
Yeah. Don't criminalize it. Yeah.
Don't criminalize it. Don't make it into pornography. It's not about that at all.
So not a spectacle.
Yeah. Yes, it's not a spectacle. It's very private. It's very personal. Unfortunately, we have this, and I understand why, we need to protect young people. But I have to tell you, Raf, I've been sexual since I was born. My mother was telling me things I was doing well before the age of five. By the time I was five, I clearly knew what the clitoris was. I didn't know the name, but I knew it was fantastic. And I didn't have problems having multiple orgasms all the time. This was the thing as a child. And so to think that children are not sexual beings is a fault. And then secondarily, then when we'll talk about this with the five stages, that erotic innocence has to be preserved. Mm. We impose a pornographic adult version of sex onto a very innocent sexual being.
I see. I hear you. So let's delve, please, into the five stages of erotic evolution.
Yes.
Because well, I know that stage one is erotic innocence.
Yeah. And so we're all born that way. And what I mean by that is if you look at a young baby, it's touching its whole body and enjoying all the sensations. It doesn't matter if it's touching its nose, its elbow, its belly button, its bum hole, its genitals, its knee, its toes. It's all like, blah, 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 like it feels good.
Yeah.
And even what's interesting, Raf, is that they've done ultrasounds on pregnant women and have found that female and male, so babies, masturbating to orgasm.
Interesting.
Over and over and over and over again.
So self-pleasure is innate.
Basically. It's innate and it's intelligent because if you look at it through the eyes of a different tradition, say Taoist tradition, they have high regard for arousal and sexual energy as the one thing that actually creates life. So it's a force that multiplies itself. Not a lot of forces multiply itself. They diffuse themselves, right? This one multiplies itself. So for a baby to know, a fetus to know, if I, you know, to have this electric sensation moving through all cells, all systems, I'm encouraging vitality, health, aliveness without any of those concepts. They're not conceptual concepts.
No, they're not.
Instinctual, natural concepts, just as a seed sprouting through the earth is instinctual and natural to the seed. It knows where to go. It knows what to do. So that erotic innocence is intact pre-birth, and then we're born into this realm of sensation, right?
Yeah, yeah.
We make sense of reality through our sensuality.
We make sense of reality through our sense of sensuality.
Through our sensuality, yeah.
Through our sensuality. I had to repeat it to myself because I love the sound of it. As poetic as it is, I think it is also true. Perhaps one of the reasons why so many of us are not that good at sensing the world and as such are feeling a bit at unease with the world is, I make here a strong correlation, is our unease with actually getting in touch, accepting, appreciating, empowering, acknowledging our own sense of sensuality. And that's perhaps also why when you want to teach someone how to have better sexual relationships, you tend to, correct me if I'm wrong, to advise them to get in touch with their own sexuality first through self-pleasure.
Absolutely.
As a method.
Yeah, awesome. Absolutely. And sex becomes way better. I mean, we're talking about kind of really basic experience to the sublime with one ingredient, and it's adding the sensual. It's paying attention to all the senses and intentionally activating them, not only externally, but introceptively from the inside of your body outward, where you're really tracking, like as a scent comes in, what is the impact of that scent?
Mm-hmm.
How does it feel? And then going, wow, it kind of turns me on. Can I amplify that? That is the respectful way of engaging really with sensuality is it's receiving these gifts of information. So for a child, a baby, this is overwhelming. You can imagine the brain is forming and there's so much information. They're completely plastic. The amount of a child from, I think, 0 to 5, the learning rate is phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all being informed through the senses.
Yeah.
So very, very important. And so therefore our role as adults that are around these little beings that are erotically innocent is to provide guidance and protection without imposing social mandates of touch yourself. It's disgusting. That's not part of erotic innocence. That's an imposed ideal that isn't even ideal in my mind, but you know, and maybe it was there for protection in the past. Maybe aroused children would cause misbehaving adults to do certain choices that were not safe for children. But I'm talking ideally good parenting or good guardianship that has profound respect for the little beings and knows that they're discovering this wonderful world, and some part of that world is pleasure to do with touching one's genitals.
Thank you for this. Now, I want to read out the 5 different stages that you have written about in your book, Desire. And then I'm going to ask you how you came about, you know, putting those five stages together, sure. whether it was given to you or through your studies or through your life.
Yeah.
And then we can move on to stage number two. So Perfect. Five stages of erotic evolution. Number one, what we just talked about, the erotic innocence. Number two, erotic activation. Number three, erotic exploration. Number four, erotic expansion. And number five, erotic wisdom. Mm. So as I mentioned, first, I'm interested to know how you, as a clinical psychologist, as well as a sexual being, how do you relate to those five stages, how they came about to you, that you, you know, actually wrote about? And then we can move on to also stage two.
You know, it's interesting because I didn't read about that anywhere.
Oh, okay.
I think it's about observing in my career, but before my career, because I'd been coaching. I mean, I started teaching sex stuff when I was five because I was telling other girls about their clitoris. Mm-hmm. When I was a teenager, I had file folders on every single girlfriend who was going through, you know, difficulties with sex and relationship. So obviously I was very interested already in the psychosexual stuff back then.
Mm-hmm.
And so it started very young, this fascination. And then I entered this field of work. And I've heard tens of thousands of people by now sharing their journeys, their life experience, the blockages and the exalted moments, all of that.
Mm.
I think over time, those ideas, it is a theory, but they formed themselves through observing what seemed very natural. And I was thinking about it, Raf, in this way. We encourage children to grow physically. So there's a physical evolution, maturity process of the body. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants a baby to become an adult body. No questions asked. And then there's, to an extent, a mental maturity that happens through education in school. We would prefer people are educated and know how to think and know how to, you know, read and write and all of that. So those two facets are very much part of society now. Maybe spirituality to an extent, depending on the kind of culture you grow up in, there could be an encouragement of that. But emotionally and sexually, I was not seeing any living examples. What does an emotionally mature adult look like? Mm. What does a sexually mature adult look like? I don't mean the development of the gonads. I mean behaviorally yeah. mature sexually.
In real practical terms. Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I don't know. There's no examples that I can think of. They're exceptionally rare.
Mm.
So then it became clear to me that these two weak pillars in our evolutionary process as a person needed to be addressed. And the work that I was doing was addressing both simultaneously, that psychosexual development. So the stages became kind of an obvious lens through which I was looking. So erotic innocence seemed really obvious. Children are erotic and they're innocent. And it's mm-hmm. a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
And I actually think erotic innocence can heal adults, meaning reactivating our own, where we don't have judgment of right, wrong, good, bad around anything to do with our own desire, sexual desire.
I see.
And then there's the second stage, which we haven't discussed yet, which is the activation, which is super obvious. When your hormones kick in as a kid, the whole world changes for you. Suddenly you went from being a kid to then sex. And what is this? And this is overwhelming. And it can begin quite young. You know, it could be like 7, 8, 9 years old for some kids. And it can start quite late into the teen years. Mm-hmm. But it's an overwhelming biological imperative to mature the physical body through a sexual activation so that you are able to produce children and I'm also able to produce children, basically yeah. biologically, right?
Yeah.
You cannot avoid that. It's very, very intense and it makes you incredibly curious. We could go more into that, but I just kind of want to list the ones, you know, that you said in terms of, so that seemed obvious to me.
Yeah.
And then I was kind of thinking of, well, young people do explore a lot. You know, they watch porn, they read sex books, they go to sex parties, they, I don't know, play sex games at parties. They just try things. And mm-hmm. so it seemed obvious that at a younger age, it's a good time to explore, discover what we like and don't like.
Yeah.
But when a mature person, say a man in his late 50s, starts to behave like a young adult doing that, we don't really respect that person. And so that became obvious to me as the stage has to happen early in life for the society to kind of respect it a little bit more. We have harsher views on someone who's older, who's doing exploration in all kinds of directions, than we do of a young person.
I see.
It's unfortunate, but it just seems evolutionary to make sense.
Yeah. It seems like by the time you get to a certain age, you're supposed to know.
Yes. And if you'd gone through that stage and you weren't repressed and you didn't have all these like, don't do these things, you would then have the sexual life experience to actually be a better lover for yourself and others. But because most of us are afraid to really go into that exploration stage, and then we have judgments around it and shame around it, then we inhibit the growth process of learning. And it's a very important time of like, I like this, I don't like that. We need to discover those things.
Yeah.
But they're very basic, Raf. They're not like extraordinary sexual things. They're just basic, like orientation wise, types of touch, types of kinks, types of all kinds, very basic.
I see. Yeah.
So then I was thinking, well, there's more to that though. And almost everyone I know at some point in their life comes to a moment where they ask themselves this one question. And when this question shows up, you always know that the fourth stage, erotic expansion, has arrived. And the question is, there's got to be more to sex than this, I hope, please.
Yeah.
Like almost a desperation with that.
There's got to be more to this. Yeah.
Yeah. Because we come to a place where the bare kind of basic stuff, you've kind of done it all. And then you're like, so now what?
Yeah.
Right. And so that now what question enters us into this expansive stage where we tend to then want to move into more conscious sexual ideas and experiences and yada, yada. So some people will go towards these other lineages of Tantra, Taoism, conscious sex, etc., and just try and discover what else is there. It's expansion also in the sense of becoming more aware of the subtle. The more subtle experiences. So you have to expand your mind to allow for those possibilities. So there's a lot more I can say there, but that's the fourth one.
And well, before you move on, in case you were just about to move on to number five, you mentioned early on that erotic innocence, whilst obviously obvious in terms of when being a baby and a child, can be very useful for adults as well. Can you speak of that before we move on from expansion? Where, how can we possibly reclaim that innocence as an adult and make sense of things and empower ourselves with whatever we gain from that knowledge?
I love it. Well, that is stage five. So stage five is erotic wisdom, but it's a coming back to erotic innocence, but from the adult perspective.
I see.
And stage five is the only stage that is not externally oriented or validated. All the other stages, you're looking to mom and dad, you're looking to your peers, you're looking to porn or teachers or books, you're looking to lineages. It's all external kind of feedback loops. Erotic wisdom is when you finally are content with your own being and you self-validate and you start to self-generate. And that's when erotic innocence comes back, because now you let go of all these judgments and good, bad, right, wrong. And you sit with, well, this is very pleasurable for me and I don't have to act on it because it's not appropriate in this instance, but over here it is. And so you have better choice making abilities. So that reclamation of innocence is part of the evolutionary process. It could happen before stage five, but in general, it seems to be one where a person allows themselves to be more oriented inwardly and less externally oriented, more aware of and being okay with their own unique set of erotic fingerprinting, let's say, like their way of being in the world with that. And it seems to be also a natural progression, because when you get to this place of relaxing about your sexual nature, suddenly you experience eroticism everywhere with all things.
Yeah.
You find the sunset erotic. You find the smell of a particular food or a person incredibly erotic. And you let yourself have orgasm and pleasure just from the senses, from the sensuality. And if you choose to be sexual with another, so acting on your sexual expansion and exploration and all the pieces together, there's much more of an ease, a relaxation, a willingness to go, you know, I'm really attracted to you. I would love to have this beautiful experience. Mm-hmm. It's okay if it doesn't happen, but I would love to. Here's what it looks like for me. What would it look like for you?
Yeah.
And then taking your time to almost ceremonially create an experience.
Create an experience. I hear you. Totally. Yeah. Now, obviously, if I may say, I know you are, and so am I, in your 40s. And many, many years ago, somebody explained to me how women in their 40s were basically in their prime. Do you think that is in relation to most of you having gone through those five stages and coming at a place where you're now fully aware of what you like, but also open, fully aware of what you don't like, but also open to things you don't know that you could very much like too?
I'm not sure if it's related to the five stages or not. Okay. I know that hormonally, there's definitely like a moment, like a biological moment where that's true for women. But I think there is a truth to it in terms of the psyche, because at a certain point, you stop caring what other people think.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, there was this moment where I'm like, I don't care what it will take, but Eros is remaining alive in my life. I will not be one of those women who just shuts it off and then just gets to be a very grumpy, miserable older person.
Yeah.
No way.
Mm-hmm.
Because sex and the act of sex and pleasure and Eros, there is no age limit. I don't know who put an age limit on it, but it's alive, as I said, from pre-birth until your last breath. And I have the interest to do that. And I think you're right in terms of confidence. There may be a little bit more of a feistiness to a person when they come to a certain place in their life and have had enough experience that now they're a little bit at this place of, well, it's the midlife, you know, breakthrough time. And it's the time when we have to examine, has everything I've chosen to agree to and live by actually still congruent? And what I think it is because we live so much with hijacked desires, it becomes unbearable to the essence at some point. And there's a place where biology and essence really kind of shake you up. And I think it is in the 40s. And and then we either proceed to what I call like just kind of let go of life and let go of caring. And we just let ourselves fall apart. And that's, we see a majority of people choosing that way. And then we see a select few who are like, you know what? These are going to be my best years yet. I can tell you, having trained women who are older, especially even post-menopause, all the way into their 70s, that some of the best sex of their lives is happening in those decades. So there's a breakthrough for the psyche also to let go of, I have to look young and sexy in order to have my best pleasure, which is absolutely a strange thing if you think about it. Not true at all, because if you are inwardly aware, you feel everything at all times, whether you're young or older. So it's up to you to engage with that or not.
It is a blasphemous paradox, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But that correlation that we make, and I think I am going to be gendered on this, that a lot of women make between how I look and how sexy I feel, and those two things have got to be related. True.
I think men are also confronted with how they look and feel. I mean, I know so many men who get so insecure by the midlife crisis time, and they're married, and they don't know if they want to be married anymore, and they have their career, and they don't know if they want to do their career anymore, and then it's often when they get, you know, that flashy car or like start, you know, having a young mistress, or there's like all these funny things that we attribute to this time of life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like, what is it that's going to make me feel alive? I feel so dead.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't know that having a flashy, fast car is like everybody's thing, but you know, it's the thing we associate with that. Mm-hmm. But I think it's the exhilaration of having a fine-tuned machine that you're in control of, that you can actually afford for the first time because you've done your thing.
Yeah.
I don't know that it's an identity thing as much as that. And then with the younger women, most likely it's because at this point, you just don't want to be criticized. You just want to have some fun, and younger women kind of put up with a lot just to have a bit of fun. They don't care. They don't worry about your weird traits so much. And I think with older women and younger men, it's also a thing, because I've been asking a lot of younger men, like, wow, what's going on? And they're like, well, being around older women, they're relaxed. They don't judge me. I feel like I can just be myself. So I think there is this dynamism that naturally happens. Mm-hmm. And because we have segregated, we are very ageist right now, absolutely ageist, and we segregate. We don't have mixed groups where there's all ages interacting and engaging with each other like we used to, where the elders and the children and the all ages dancing together, being together, interacting together. There's a starvation of where youthful exuberance needs to also meet that mature wisdom, and have the youthfulness inspire those who've matured with some energy, and then the young getting infused with some wisdom. Like, this is really, really missing in our culture.
And
we especially do it sexually, Ralph. Like, once you're 40, you should not be having sex. It's disgusting, according to younger people.
So, really?
Yeah, absolutely disgusting. Okay. I mean, it's, I get emails from young women who are 21, terrified of aging, because they feel they will no longer be viable women by the time they're 25 to 30, say that age range.
We'll see. Interesting.
And so culturally, there's a thing around that, which is not in my world, but I see it. I see the pain of it. So I would love to see us, like, let go of those constructs of age in terms of, if you're an adult, you're an adult. And it might be good to interface with all kinds of different adults. And
yes, I mean, I think that for that, one solution is to stop criminalizing and making everyone feel guilty about those desires that are, those impulses that are sexual, sensual at times, and stop making people feel bad about wanting to explore without knowing full well exactly what they want.
Yes.
You know, something I've learned to kiss with older women. Now, I am talking, I've started kissing, and we talked about kissing briefly before, you and I, fairly young with people my age. But by the time I got to the age of 16, 17, 18, I've always been attracted to older women, but especially women around their 40s for some reason. I was not putting a number on it at the time, but now that I remember, it was those women who I found the most attractive for various reasons that we can go into. But just the art of kissing, the art of listening with one's mouth, the art of expressing how much desire you have for this person, was to me educated, talked, and developed with and alongside women who were 20 years older than me. And that's why I was asking you, really, because I grew up around other dudes also were always attracted to older women. Mm-hmm. Not because sex was easier to get, but because there was something of getting an education as well.
Agreed. And that how it was like for me as well. I only wanted really for a while to date people who were older so I could learn. Because I was like, I'm not going to learn from people my own age. So there's a knowing. And yet, again, there's a lot of taboos around these things. So
true.
The thing that we don't understand culturally is that 0 to 100 is really what we think of sex or eros. Zero, there's nothing going on. 100, you're fucking. That's it.
Yeah.
But there's 1 to 99. And in that erotic spectrum, there's so many nuances. You could have an exquisite, say, an erotic massage where there's no genital-to-genital contact, but you're still engaging with the genitals, just even through touch. You don't even have to do anything oral. But imagine younger people understanding we're just going to do a pleasure session. How much pleasure can I give you just through touch?
No.
Or as you said, how much pleasure can I experience and give another through a kiss or through a dance or through, like, there's so much more available.
Mm.
And because we're not discussing pleasure and we're not discussing the greater spectrum, and then we're like, it's forbidden, because what we're saying is forbidden is for a young person to have sex with an older person.
Yeah.
Which makes sense. There's reasons for that, for protection reasons, but there's also not logical. There's aspects of it that's not logical.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, culture comes against, in the name of protection, against, and in the name of morality as well, depending on the country and the culture that you're in. I remember being 17 and having an affair with this, she must have been 44 or 45 year old woman. It would be such a big deal right now if that was to come out, you know. And I'm hoping, in all honesty, and I mean no disrespect to anyone who thinks against what I'm about to say, that some young people, both men and women, young men and women out there, age 17, are actually getting what they want through the gift of being with someone older. Now, all within their own accords, all within, you know, not being forced on anything else. For me, it was totally, I want this. This is great. There was no headaches. There was no arguments. There was a bit of emotionality in there, and eventually it ended. But the letting yourself loose and allowing yourself to just be wild with someone that you can trust has been there before has allowed me to be comfortable enough with myself to actually hear criticism or suggestions as to how to do it and make it better.
Exactly.
My ego wasn't as hurt also, you know, when something was not really working.
Because you were curious.
Exactly. And I was allowed to be curious. I think that's my point.
And you were allowed to not know everything.
Totally. And I was allowed to explore in ways that very likely my mom didn't explore. Very likely my dad didn't explore. I'm a parent myself. My kids are 14, 16, and 23 right now. And obviously I think of those things. So when I say this, I'm not saying this as just a 43-year-old man who likes sex. I also say that as a parent who now, you know, looking at my 16-year-old who's, I know, sexually active, as you said early on, it doesn't seem to be mixing a lot with older people. But between us, and obviously it's now recorded, so it will be public of some sort, I wish for him that he finds that older woman with whom he can learn how to treat younger women better.
Mm. And I think
I wish that upon him, seriously. Yeah.
I think it's an issue of sexual sovereignty, and I think the laws are to protect abusers, right? Mm-hmm. So we don't want pedophiles to be able to have access to children, sure. Period. However, there's a sense of sexual sovereignty. So if the adult engaged really understands, I'm engaging with a young person, this is something I have to do with care and with deep respect because I have impact. I'm going to impact this person's life. And if you have that kind of consciousness going into it and you're asking the right questions, I think that's, you know, a beautiful thing. I did wait till I turned 18 just to get that out of the way. However, like I said, there's some cultures where it is younger. There is younger. But I don't think it's bad for young people to experiment. I just think it's not great for young people to have sex. I think they would be better served to explore pleasure. Erotic pleasure,
sure.
Versus going immediately into penis, vagina stimulation for heterosexual or like any kind of genital contact instantly. I think that's what we see in porn, and that's what they expect. Mm-hmm. It's what they want, mm-hmm. But it's not that satisfying. Mm-hmm. It doesn't teach you much. I think sexual tension is one of the most erotically enlivening things you can experience. Mm-hmm. We don't teach kids how to like enjoy that, just be in it.
Yeah.
You know, that tension before you ever, that first kiss, and you're not kissing yet and you just feel that electricity between you.
Yeah.
How long can you enjoy that versus just rushing from that to intercourse, for example?
I was talking about that with a friend of mine recently, and we talked about, she grew up here in the UK. I grew up in Paris, And we talked about exactly that, where I'll give you the example of mine. I grew up going out and dancing a lot. So this stage that you mentioned before even the kiss. And for us, dancing zouk, which is a partnered mm-hmm. dance similar to what now is called, you know, bachata or kizomba or even tango to an extent. And I wouldn't say salsa because it's we are against each other. We can actually feel, sense and smell each other. And you don't know each other's name. So you go out with friends and sensuality is basically the name of the game. And I grew up with that. So for me, it was always a case of this comes first. I didn't know it, but I was now learning about foreplay, about the building desire, this force, mm-hmm. this force energy that we talked about early on, of wanting this, but somehow holding it within a container of some sort before expressing it. My friend on the other side grew up here where the culture was pubs, drugs, and alcohol. And, you know, we talked freely about it. And she said, you know, I did not really discover good sex up until I was in my mid-30s because sex for us was always something that you do when you are half drunk. There's no sensual touch to it. It's a kind of a wham bam type of thing. It tends to be rough. It mm-hmm. tends to be denied of intimacy to an extent. Mm-hmm. And I mean, she said that to me, and don't get me wrong, many other people have expressed similar views and shared similar views with me. But I'm now comparing cultures and as to what we invite others. Also, one of my things about going out dancing is that I would be dancing with older women. So I've learned to touch women of different size, of different age, I could sense how different they liked to be grabbed. Because within the dancing, you actually grab each other. The amount of subtleties that each person would be walking with, would be capable of sensing, would be capable of sharing, all of that without words.
Yes.
And that I would love to somehow bring back. And now COVID has done a couple of things, but one of the things that I am sad looking at my kids here is the fact that they don't go out very much. Mm-hmm. It's everything is online. And, you know, the dancing is not, I'm here in England and my kids are not really into dancing the way I was, interestingly enough. The going out with friends is not the doing things that we used to do. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if you know, but I've never been drunk because alcohol was just looked down upon. It was a case of, you know, if you're drunk, you're going to look like an idiot. So never really been there for us. It was a case of how can you dress well, smell well, and how many numbers, what numbers can you grab from those people that you dance with so that eventually that stage of eroticism and desire can actually transpire and transfer into a stage where we speak on the phone and then there's that courtship that happens.
Exactly.
And then eventually there's a bit of dry humping and more kissing and eventually there's a bit of sex and if not a shitload of sex. Yeah. But we add those stages. Yeah. And, you know, I know I sound like an old man going like, back in the day, we used to do it like this. But I now, I am reverse engineering, so to speak, my own childhood, my own growth as a lover, you know, not just as a man, but also as a lover. How come I am, look, I'm going to share something and then I'll ask you this question as well. Rough sex, you know, as in having sex and being rough with your partner. Right? It's something that I am myself really only got into in my 30s. And I've had many, many comments of this was so slow and this was so sensual. Thank you. And the truth is, my ego is like, okay, cool. You know, the bed is wet. I can tell that I've done a good job right here. But the truth is, I did not understand the compliment. Mm. Because also, whilst there was porn, I've never really watched it that much. And even now, I don't really do that. To me, it was always about that sensuality. The music is on and the hips and the pelvis mm-hmm. is moving slow. And you allow yourself to really smell, sense, you know. And eventually, being in bed with someone, you know, or would say to me, you know, come on, fuck me. Oh, I did not realize that all I could do was make love. So now I got into the actual physical fucking aspect. Now, if you don't mind sharing, was there phases or were there times in your sexual lives where you've realized that you actually went from one way of doing things to another? I know you were sexually curious from very, very young, but in terms of the interactions with others, anything you care to share?
Yeah, I do. I had a bit of an opposite experience. So I knew, because I counseled so many girlfriends, I was like, when I have sex, I don't want any emotional involvement. I just want the sex bit.
I see.
So I would intentionally not want to be involved, and I wouldn't have often repeat experiences for that fear of the person having feelings for me.
Wow.
I was just purely raw animal person trying to seduce, you know, the most desirable person. And anyways, fast forward to a moment where I did meet somebody. When I first met him, I think we had sex within the first hour or two of meeting. Barely knew him. And that was my style. I didn't even need to know your name. I was just like, I wanted to know other parts of you more than I did want to know your name. So there was a moment where that person, we did have a repeat a few times, but I do remember this one experience with him. My whole body was shimmering and shaking, and I didn't know what had happened. And it was so intense, and it was so different than all the other times that I kind of gasped out loud, like, what have you done? What just happened? And he said, I made love with you. And it hit me like a stone wall. I was like, oh, that's what that is. And I really like that. So of course, now I like the full spectrum. But I, in opposite to you, hadn't had any lovers that were careful or loving or sweet or sensual. It was always, you know, in the beginning.
Yeah. What age did you say this happened?
I was 18 to, I think I was 19 when I had that activation. And then after that, I did explore being in love and having a partner for a long time. And I did longer stints with partnerships, two at four, and then much longer after. But there is something lovely when we can allow for the whole spectrum.
Oh, and totally.
I think there are times of the month, at least for female cyclical body, right before the menstrual cycle, for me anyways, that's when I want the animalistic sex. I almost want it to hurt just a little bit. Like it's like very intense. And then there's other times where it just has to be refined and subtle to the point of like barely moving. And that's very ecstatic. So I appreciate a range of ability within one lover. It's not always there, but I do appreciate that range.
Yeah, totally. I hear that. And I think that the range is only... I'm perhaps not, but I'm thinking about age again, going back to those five stages. It can only begin gained through experience, through exploration, through expansion, through trying a few things out, and also appreciating that what you liked 5 years ago, 10 years ago may not be as fancied as much, and versa for all those things that you didn't like back in the day. And to realize that there's this range that you can really be happy with and within. I mentioned to you early on that a lot of us feel entitled to have good sex, but not a lot of us feel fulfilled. And perhaps many of us would do well to explore more of that range, as opposed to say, I want more of this and only this. Because very often, I'm sure you'll agree, it's a case of when you think you want one thing, what you need is actually something else.
Yes.
Between the want and needs, there are differences.
And I would say if you want to have satisfaction, if you actually want to thoroughly, as the statement goes, be well fucked, like where you're just like, God, yes, thank you. It involves a degree for all parties of the ability to receive, fully receive what is emerging, whether it is a scent or a taste or a touch. But if you're numb, And the only kind of sensation you can get is a vigorous rubbing of mutual masturbation.
Hmm.
Not very satisfying. But if you start to resensitize the body, if you start to resensitize the genitals, if you start to take a risk and actually open the heart a little bit and feel, mm-hmm. allow an emotive quality to come, even if you're not in love, you can still open and see deeper into the person that you're sharing an experience with.
Yeah.
Just for the moment, you could have a very divine ecstatic experience in a one night stand that could be life changing.
Yeah.
So how do we meet that mystery through sex? How do we receive what is actually emerging? How sensual are we? How awake are we? How willing are we to receive pleasure? For a lot of times when I'm very sensual, so I've touched certain bodies and it can tell that they've never been touched mm-hmm. anywhere except but their genitals.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, wow, because the entire body is an erogenous zone.
Yeah.
Where could I elicit more pleasure? How can I wake up this area? If we start to explore even the same person that we've been with for 20 X years, whatever it might be,
mm-hmm.
explore them, but for long-term couples, I often use this, and I use it a lot in my relationship as well, is in this moment, if you could use the meditation or the intent of this is the first time I've ever touched this person,
mm.
it's also going to be the last time I will ever touch them simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
You will touch very differently. You will experience something close to magical when you allow your awareness to really be deeply present with the truth. And the truth is, in this moment, it is true. You've actually never touched this person in this moment
yeah.
before.
Yeah.
And it is true that this is the last time. Because honestly, you can't guarantee. I mean, someone could die tomorrow. Something can happen and the relationship ends. You just do not know. If I track back to last times with partners, I didn't know mm-hmm. that was going to be the last time.
Yep. Yep.
And so if we can bring that's kind of, you know, using the erotic exploration expansion side of things, where you use your intention to actually create an experience. This is a higher level of sexual mastery, but when you start to use that, it's really fabulous. And it's also true. You can practice this every day through your sensuality. When you drink something, don't just absently drink it. Feel the texture.
Yeah.
Taste the taste. Feel it go into the body. Notice the impact
mm-hmm.
With food, with clothing, with bathing. We forget. We rush so much in life and we're thinking too many thoughts. We're always in this head and kind of like we do when we flip through our screen.
Yes, the concept of self-pleasure is a much bigger one than just the sexual one.
Yes.
And the micro to the micro, the micro to the micro can very much be worked on, in that if you can allow yourself or walk towards building the capacity to yes. allow yourself to sense better when you put something in your mouth, yes. when you put something on your skin, when you bathe, when you smell a certain way, so on. So it will help you in those intimate moments when you are with someone else. And it doesn't have to be sexual for you to start learning how to sense things better.
Yeah.
But Saida, I want to go back to something you just mentioned about the emotive quality of an interaction. You've shared with us early on that for quite a few years, you had sex perhaps only one time because you were basically running away from the possibility of emoting mm-hmm. Both yourself and the other person. And also you've given us the idea of touching someone as if it was the last time. Now, I remember myself, again, education and getting good at something has always been something very important for me. And I remember when I was younger, a guy, an older guy, you know, we talked about sex quite a lot amongst friends. And an older guy came back one day. We were at the bottom of my building, you know, lads being lads talking, and he came back with his girlfriend, and she was so very sweet, a beautiful woman, and we looked up to this guy, you know. And this woman, who we knew from afar, was very fiery and a strong, beautiful woman, but with him she seemed like a kitten. And So at some point, he sent her off to get something in a car or whatever. And, you know, one of us turned to him and said, what did you do to her? Now, how do you do this? Like, you know, how do you make those beautiful, strong-minded women kind of be so calm around you? And he said to us, oh, it's simple. Every time I make love to her, well, he used the word fuck. Every time I fuck her like it's the last time.
Yeah.
And it blew our mind. And most of us kind of looked at each other going, what kind of bullshit is this? Because, you know, you're 16, 17. Like, no, give me like the positions first that you put them in. Like, give me some practical things that...
techniques.
That are exactly techniques. And you're talking to me about energy, basically. It's like, no, just do it like it's the last time. So you're really there. There's a reverence to it. Mm-hmm. And yes, you know, I started walking with that eventually and it worked. So anyhow, to come back to my question, were you educated in the, where did you get that education of keeping people at bay? Was that your personality type that is different than mine? Was that something that you saw your parents or people around you, the older woman around you, mm-hmm. not wanting to get attached? You know, if I may ask, what made you wanting to stay away from emotions and just keep everything physical?
Well, I was a very good kid. I never drank. I didn't do drugs. I didn't do anything that my parents had ever freaked out about. But one concern my parents had, my mother especially, was she's like, don't just have sex, like make love. It's just so much better. Mm-hmm. And it was like the only way I could rebel is just to fuck because she wanted me to make love.
Okay.
I think it's unconscious, but there's a thing that to become your own person, you've got to find your own way. Mm-hmm. And then the truth is, I mean, none of my lovers believed I was inexperienced because I was very experienced alone. So I had a capacity, let's say, that was unusual for someone new to sex. But mm-hmm. I think it's because I'd had so much with myself. So I was really just more interested in learning, like you said, techniques, positions, experiences. How do I do this thing and that thing and do it better? And that's more where I was coming from. And I think also because I was counseling so many friends and they were having so many heartaches around guys, mm-hmm. I was like, I ain't going to be one of those girls. I'm going to get what I want and then get my ass out of there. You know, but it's not true now. I mean, when I started to work on reconnecting my heart and my genitals together and that conscience, because I was very not sweet. I mean, if you were married, I would go for you.
I see.
And I would get you.
You were a bad girl, basically.
I would get you. And then I would disrespect you because you said yes to me and I wanted to say no. Mm-hmm. So the first man who ever said no to me, I fell in love with.
Of course. As one does, yes. Mm-hmm.
So that was a very young cycle from 18 and year 18 and year 19. By 20, I was like, I can't do that. I grew a conscience basically. And when I've just ruined some beautiful relationships, I'm sure, for what? For nothing. Mm-hmm. But that's part also, like, for women, for sure, discovering you're sexually attractive and you can get what you want is power.
Yeah.
It's power. And we're not taught how to handle that power. I self-discovered how to handle it. There was no guidance, especially for someone like me, who's a self-proclaimed quote unquote slut. I mean, I just really love sex. I've always loved it. It's never something I've not enjoyed. Mm-hmm. So there's not a culture of like, well, what about women who really love sex? Mm. Because the only word that comes with that is slut, and you're ashamed to be called a slut. I mean, that's how people shame you with that word. So
that is so weird. That is so weird. It's like I've been I like to think of myself as, I mean, you know me personally, I tend to be fairly socially aware and I'm a decent judge of character, but I'm also very naive, you know, the paradox of it all, because all of that is so, it's not new to me, but it's so not what I've ever allowed my eyes to stay on or my ears to stay on. It's like my bullshit detector, even when I was younger, to me, it was always about growth, get better. Pleasure is something to be gained, but it's also something to give. Granted, I grew up in Paris, in France, in the 80s and 90s. The environment plays a very, very important part.
Yes.
I didn't have conversations about sex, you know, per se at home, but I have a good relationship with my mom, and I'm sure that plays a big part into it. I love women because I've learned a lot from her, and I'm sure that's part of the way I was talked out to be the man that I am right now. And I'm using those words on purpose. I was talked how to be the man that I am right now. I am not self-made. The environment, the men, all the guys, the woman, all the women, my mother are all responsible for all the good things that I do. The bad choices, just they're mine. Just mine. But I feel myself being very naive when you say those things, because in terms of ages, you know, looking down at older people, looking down at women who like sex. Like, dude, I mean, especially if you're straight, a woman who likes sex is fucking good news as far as you're concerned, because you know what I mean. I've never really fully understood the lack of congruence between, oh, she's a slut because she fucked me five times. It makes no sense. Like, she's giving you something that you want and you liked it. For you to turn her on and then call her a bad name makes no freaking sense whatsoever. Now, obviously, with age and with time, now, especially training as a psychotherapist, I understand that it was nothing to do with the sex. Mm-hmm. I understand that you got your heart broken. You didn't get what you wanted. Your little sense of entitlement is hurt, because that sex was possibly so very good that you wish you could keep getting it, and you're not anymore. So she's now obviously on the other side.
Yeah.
But that's on you. Like, you know what I mean? So yeah, all of that to say, what you're sharing with me, which I've heard before, and I'm sure I'm going to hear many, many more times, are things that I can't really relate directly. Not to say I haven't been an asshole. I'm pretty sure I have.
We all have.
Yeah. We all have, because, you know, by the time you don't give someone what they want, you know, you are being an asshole. But it is one of those things where I'm not an angel whatsoever, but it's never been my intention to stay away. Like, let's talk briefly, if we can, about one night stands.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to bring back the transgressive side of Eros, because I think it's very important that we discuss this. I think that too many times we try and squish Eros.
So one thing that I'd love for us to talk some more about is the concept of one night stands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where you have that quick gift of pleasure, ideally. Now, you made it sound as if you had a few. I've had, I want to say, one or two, perhaps. And, you know, I've been with many women, but one night stand is just, I'm not wired that way. So, you know, I know you're going to be talking, we are, this podcast today is about Eros. Mm-hmm. And we talked about all the goodness of Eros. Is there something else that Eros can actually,
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about what makes Eros thrive, which is the transgressive side of things.
The transgressive side of Eros, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to be transgressive, I mean, it's a range, a huge range. For some people, transgressive Eros would be just turning the light on. Right? It's anything that you're afraid to do but really want to do, and it accentuates the erotic moment. So let's just define it that way, because it is a massive spectrum.
Okay.
Right. So it's very hard to like list it all. But yeah, we need the transgressive side. The things that make Eros thrive. Eros loves novelty. It really thrives if maybe, say, a couple, they always have sex in the bedroom, and then they just decide they're gonna have sex in the living room.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the in-laws are visiting and they're in the other room. That's very transgressive, for example, for a couple that strictly stays in the bedroom. If you do too many things that are the same and comfortable, it can actually almost flatline Eros, which is why going away on a holiday, often people feel like they have another honeymoon. It's just purely because they've unplugged, they're in a different environment, and they can put their attention to the erotic side of things, and they're transgressing in that sense, right? They're doing something unusual. So how we cultivate transgression, I actually think we need to cultivate it. I think it's actually very important. The easiest and safest way, because it terrifies us, we say transgression, well, you know, we're terrified. Is it going to destroy my relationship? Am I going to get a disease? Like, there's like, you know, this range of terror. But the easiest way to transgress with a partner and that is safe, that won't destroy the experience, is through fantasy. Because the mind doesn't know the difference between a fantasy and reality. And they've seen that with Olympic athletes that train and they visualize the whole track or whatever it is that they're doing. And the body and all the chemicals are produced exactly as though they're running that race. And mm-hmm. it's just a fantasy. So fantasy is very important because it allows you to experiment with various thoughts and to discover when you get to the end of it, whether or not that was a successful idea or not.
I see.
So I'll describe one for me. So with my partner, he had come from another relationship where it was, he lived with his partner and another woman for like months.
Okay.
And he really wanted to share me, but with another woman. And he didn't understand that I come from a background where I've had so much betrayal from women that the idea of, and I have had those experiences, but then they just were never empowering experiences. Mm-hmm. They were always very emotionally painful experiences. So the idea of it was terrifying for me. So every time he would bring it up, I would shut down erotically. So what did I do? I decided to be transgressive. I actually hand wrote a fantasy about a threesome. And my psyche, the erotic mind is fabulous because mm-hmm. there's so much healing that can happen when we choose to go in that transgressive space. And you do it at your own pace and you do it with your own timing. But if you're willing to explore, there's a richness there. The landscape is vast. So I hand wrote this fantasy and I'm sobbing as I'm experiencing it because it's so real.
Mm.
But then there was also completion because I faced the thing I was terrified of in a fantasy. Now it actually never happened ever in reality. But there was like this completion that occurred. He never asked me again. We did other things that were transgressive, but it's like he lost his obsession with it when I lost my terror of it.
Interesting.
Right. Mm-hmm. So what we decided to do, let's take it a step further. He took me through fantasies while we were having sex mm-hmm. and telling me what he'd be doing to this other person. Mm-hmm. He soon realized that if he brought in another woman, it would always end up in tears.
Mm-hmm.
And I would ask him to get rid of her and then she would leave the room and we would continue. Mm-hmm. And but that wasn't exciting for him to see me go through this psychological distress.
Mm-hmm.
So then he's like, well, what would happen if I imagined another guy? And I would go wild, absolutely crazy. And so he's like, okay, well, this is where we're going. Because he had a love of the transgressive spaces. He wasn't afraid of them. They're fantasies, safe sex, and why not? So I always loved and appreciated that so deeply about my partner, who was willing to verbalize fantasy. It was almost impossible for me to verbalize them. I could write them down,
mm-hmm.
but to say what I want was a whole other level of transgression for my psyche, even though I'm completely free and quite slutty and like, you know, mm-hmm. done a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Because fantasy is so potent, there was something about the speaking to that. So in terms of cultivating transgressive eros,
yeah.
I think this is a very healthy place for everybody. Now, it can tell you a lot about yourself. There's a really great book called The Erotic Mind by Jack Morin.
Okay.
And it's a great read. And I agree with a lot of what he said. And I noticed in my life, there were phases where a recurring fantasy would keep happening. And it would really turn me on. And some of the things were disturbing. They're not nice. They were very disturbing, incredibly transgressive. But it was something because I was violated and nearly died from that. So there was something my psyche had to work out being helpless and violated.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the bulk of my fantasy in the few years after the experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I would get so turned on. But you see, when you're fantasizing, you're in control.
Yeah.
And many, many people, they don't want to talk about it, but rape fantasies are incredibly popular.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I think the psyche is trying to deal with something.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's a raw primal aspect to it. There's the aspect of being taken. There's the aspect of not having control. It's not that you actually want to have an actual rape experience, but the elements that come into the fantasy.
Of losing control. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So at some point, I lost total interest in that one thematic fantasy that kept recurring. And that's when my psyche had completed and it's never returned. So often with clients, I say, let's not judge what's emerging.
Mm-hmm.
You're not hurting yourself. You're not hurting anybody. This is an important something that's moving through. You're using eros, arousal, to move it through the psyche. This is very good, actually. Self-therapy. And it's not causing you to go out and misbehave in ways that are detrimental to your well-being.
Mm.
So when you can give permission for those transgressive spaces, it's like you can breathe erotically. There's something that can happen where it's like, you mean I'm allowed to even have that thought?
Mm-hmm.
It's huge in a puritanical world where, you know, these thoughts are not allowed.
But it can bring about so much healing, as you said. It can be a cycle that you can then eventually complete, put aside, you've dealt with.
Yeah.
It's powerful.
Yeah.
Very, very powerful.
And also then for, you know, many, because a lot of my clients are female and they identify as straight.
Mm-hmm.
They say, I don't know what to do. I keep having gay fantasies.
Mm-hmm.
I just really want to discover another woman's body. I'm like, well, in your psyche, there's no difference between another woman's body and your own body. So what are the qualities? What's happening? And they were touching the woman in ways that their own partner wasn't touching themselves.
I see. Yeah, yeah.
So they were giving the thing they desired. And I said, well, those are the things you then get to communicate to your partner.
Hmm.
In its good information.
Yeah.
So that's why I love these transgressive spaces. If they're dealt with that erotic wisdom from that space of like, what can I learn? And can I just be a yes and have erotic innocence around the emergence of it? And can I dare to then share possibly with my partner an element of it, an aspect of it?
Yeah. It's in the sharing that growth will then take place, right? But obviously that implies something. You somehow need to learn to communicate that. You also need to be with someone who's willing to learn and grow with you within that growth of that vocabulary that you're going to be using with each other.
If you can't, then it will come out sideways. And that's when people have affairs and they make very bad decisions. And look, many cultures are affair cultures anyways. Everybody's doing these things, as you said, very early in the podcast. And that's when sexuality, like it just goes sideways and it's weird and it's not helpful and it's hurtful. And I think that's why there's all these controls around it, is to try and prevent all this crazy hurt and because it actually is very disruptive to a family, to a society. If there's too much of this, there's not a lot of stability. Right? So society's dependent on how stable relationships are, actually.
Yes. Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I mean, as you know, I grew up in France where you could call it a culture of affairs. Mm-hmm. They seem to be doing all right in terms of on the world map. So I wouldn't necessarily just say that cultures who have a lot of affairs are not bad compared to those who control those things, because actually affairs, I think, save quite a lot of marriages and a lot of relationships.
What I mean, though, is it's acceptable in France to have affairs. So the collective is okay with it. In a collective that's not okay with it, it's destabilizing.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that we shouldn't or should, whatever. I don't care what people do. It's
I know you don't. I'm thinking about transgressive side of that's. I'm sorry. I'm thinking about that transgressive side of eros, and you've obviously made me think about my own thoughts that I rarely shared with anyone. And since this is the Sweet Blasphemy podcast, where I ask my guests to share things that perhaps they haven't shared with anyone before, I'm also on the spot, and I'm now thinking back to a few of my girlfriends, right? And it's, you know, it's always the same thing. When you speak about something, it comes back to you, even though you've forgotten about it.
Yes.
But I want to say, I'm going to say all, if not close to all of my girlfriends, I have fantasized about being with their mother.
Interesting.
Now, I don't know whether it's something to do with my mother. You know what I mean? I love my mom, but not like that type of thing. But it's always, and again, I mean, I've shared with you that I've always been attracted to older women. And obviously most of my girlfriends were around my age, if not slightly older. It's always older, as in by 2, 3, 4, 5 years. Yeah. But if there was a mother in a picture, there was always some type of fantasy around that. And it wouldn't be a threesome. It would just be me and the mother.
Yeah.
And very often in the midst of having sex with the daughter, I'd be thinking about the mother. Never actually thought of it, never actually voiced that to anyone before today. But you got me thinking about that beautiful transgressive side of Eros and how useful it can be. I don't know whether I've done anything useful with it, because I don't remember sleeping with any one of those mothers. I slept with the mother of a good friend of mine, but it wasn't my girlfriend. But you know what I mean? I don't know what
your thoughts are. Well, it's not, as I said, transgressive fantasies are very healthy. And most of the time you won't actually act them out. So a lot of straight men will also have fantasies about men, about whatever element of that that's so transgressive and it makes them go crazy. They would never in a million years actually do it. But the thought, and it's because societally or whatever their situation is, it's so transgressive. It's just the act of considering it. It creates intense arousal because it's not allowed or it's wrong or it's bad. That parameter, okay, this is the nice fluffy things that are acceptable, yawn, boring. Outside of that, here's all the things I can't do. Oh yeah. Like it's that's how Eros, you know, just enlivens itself. So in that way, we can learn for it. Maybe there was a time where, you know, maybe the idea of a someone's mother is there's a similar look because the mother-daughter look. So it's just a hot, more experienced version of the woman you're with. I mean, it could just be as simple as that. It doesn't have to be crazy, but it could have been something simple like that.
Yeah. And I'm pretty sure it's out there because eventually the term MILF came about, and now, which is a whole genre, I'm sure, within the porn industry. Well, you know, I know that I'm not alone, not that I need not to be alone, but it's a case of, you know, we all fantasize. And I've heard of women also talking about the same in reverse, you know, fantasizing about being with the father of their boyfriends. So it is obviously something that we are, a lot of us are wired in such a way that we look up towards experience and the naughty and the forbidden.
Yes. So what I'd love to do with kind of where we want to kind of wrap this up is then look at taking us back to old lineages that understood this very wild aspect of the human being and could harness it.
Yeah.
So there are intentional practices where you self-generate. They don't actually care how you get your arousal. They don't care, you know, what you think about at all. You generate the arousal and then you harness the arousal and you work with that arousal. And suddenly you self-generate ecstatic states, but in a way that doesn't harm anyone. It enlivens your body. It improves all the systems. Everything works more optimally. And then you're also a better member of society because you're now in this place of acceptance and love and openness with yourself. And you have less need to go and act that out and make poor decisions. So there is something missing in the modern sexual, progressive sexual realms is, okay, well, yes, we could do anything we want. We can completely be hedonists and go unconscious and hurt tons of people and cause disruption. Yes, absolutely. We could do that. But that's the piece I was trying to tell you about earlier, the development of Eros alongside with the psyche. And we have to mature emotionally while we mature sexually. So as we give ourselves permission to be more free and to be more expanded and even transgressive, there's a simultaneous development of self-respect, of conscience, of sensitivity, of awareness, and being able to simultaneously, for me, it's an energetic. So your genitals come fully online and your heart comes fully online. And then when you have those two, it's almost like a steaming effect inwardly. Imagine like fire and water fully present. There's going to be this beautiful steaming effect. And it's something very magnetic. So if you have the capacity to hold both and develop both, I think that's a very worthy cause to investigate in. And there are plenty of ways to harness that through different, you know, existing technologies of practice, meditation, movement, etc. But what I really enjoy the lineages that specifically don't go into too much psychotherapy around it. They just go, we don't care how it happens in your, in your imaginary world. We care about you. Once you feel all of that desire in Eros, you use it and you use it to grow your conscience, you use it to, you know, energize your body, you use it to grow yourself as a spiritual person, et cetera. I think that's magnificent and it does hardly exist now. We've really separated spirit and sex. And in my experience, when you, let's just say consciousness and sex. So in my experience, when you start to become more and more allowing and allow that consciousness to connect with that primal impulse, now you're in that erotic wisdom phase of yes to it all, and then also making gracious choices that are for the benefit of yourself and others.
Thank you very much for being here with us. Go to rafan.co.uk for all the links and recommendations, and be in touch to tell us what you really liked about this conversation by emailing me at flow@rafan.co.uk. I'd love to hear from you. That's it for now. A bientôt.